CBS Podcasts. I am Laurence Bertrand, and this is an Editor's Choice Critical Appraisal. Today, we will take an in-depth look at the aptly named Costly TLR Study. This topic is one that affects all of us, the cost of revascularizing PAD patients with restenose or reocclosed stents. It is an open-access article published in the European Journal of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery in February of this year, and the full title is Cost Analysis of Target Lesion Revascularization in Patients with Femoropopliteal In-Stent Restenosis or Occlusion. With us today, we are honored to have two prominent authors of this article for a first-hand account. Professor Dr. Athanasios Saratsis is currently a professor of vascular surgery at the University of Leicester. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, and thank you for the invitation.
And Dr. Konstantinos Stavroulakis is an associate professor and senior consultant of vascular and endovascular surgery at Klinikum Hochsauerland and previously active here at the Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich. Dr. Stavroulakis, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Laurence, and happy to be part of this podcast.
Thank you both for joining us today, and congratulations on this important and contemporary publication in the world of PAD and health economics. Indeed, this article was chosen today because at all levels, from all sides of the vascular medicine spectrum, trainee to professor, nurse to patient, researcher to industry, and even health insurer to public health official, resource allocation and costs are increasingly important. It is very common for peripheral stenting to develop in the short or long-term restenosis and even occlusion, requiring reintervention. The redo procedures are sometimes lengthy and complex, with highly skilled surgeons using ever more sophisticated wires and catheters to salvage these arterial pathways. Many of us are left wondering, or indeed forced to ask ourselves, how much this is costing us and society as a whole. Dr. Saratsis, can you share with us how did the creation of this research project come about?
Essentially, this all started with an idea from Kostas, from Dr. Stavroulakis. We both have been looking at our data, and we've been essentially realizing over the years that there's way too many reinterventions, especially in patients with fempop stents. And then we were unsure whether using more expensive tools at baseline in order to revascularize those femoropopliteal stent segments would actually lead to better results and would actually decrease the costs in the longer term. So we were seeing quite a few reinterventions in our own centers, especially in the fempop segment, and then no one had actually looked at how much it costs to do those reinterventions.
The stated objective of the study was to report the cost of target lesion redo procedures for femoropopliteal peripheral artery disease following previous stenting from a healthcare payer's perspective. Dr. Stavroulakis, can you tell us the inclusion criteria? What specifically did you decide to look at? Are we talking about endovascular redo revascularization only?
Actually, we evaluated all patients treated with fempop in-stent restenosis or occlusions, which means that's an all-comer cohort, include patients treated by endovascular means, bypass grafting, or even hybrid procedures. So we had three groups, one treated by endovascular means, one by bypass grafting, and the third one was the procedure.
So it's femoropopliteal site only, and it's first-time restenosis or occlusion only, but any form of revascularization. Is that correct?
They might have also tibial disease or iliacs, but the inclusion criteria was to have at least one fempop stent occlusion or restenosis.
Also, what do you mean when you say from a healthcare payer's perspective? Dr. Saratsis, why was this important to stipulate?
Yeah, there's many ways in which you can look at the exact cost of a procedure or the exact cost of a medication to the patient, the society, and the healthcare system. This study was quite simple, quite straightforward. We're not looking at societal costs. We're not looking at all of the costs that incurred to the patient. For example, additional appointments for primary care or community care, or things like dressing changes after the procedure. We're looking at the exact absolute costs involved during the inpatient stay of that specific individual when they had their stent reopened or relined. So we're only looking at how much the patient's insurance paid, for example, when they were an inpatient in order to have that reintervention. So we're not looking at society costs, etc., and we're not looking at things like how many times did that patient come back to secondary care, primary care, after they went home. The important difference here is that we're looking at all comers. We're not really excluding patients. And when you do that, it's very difficult to do a societal or a taxpayers, if you like, health economic analysis, which is why we were limited to that inpatient stay.
Cost is a sophisticated and internationally diverse problem. Your study looked at 13 hospitals distributed across 6 European countries, each with their own healthcare systems and cost distribution organization. This must have been extremely challenging. Dr. Stavroulakis, can you tell us about your methods used to achieve this difficult task of measuring and comparing such costs?
So indeed, it was a very tough study. I think that collecting the data was quite difficult. So first of all, we had to go to the administration of every hospital and to ask for the specific costs of materials, but also of the time spent in the OR. For example, one and the major parameter that actually drives the cost is the time. So one important question that we had to ask is how much do we pay for every minute that we spend in the OR or in the cath lab? So we had to go to the administration of every hospital in countries that we don't have predefined costs. For example, in NHS, they have predefined costs. But in Germany, for example, in every different hospital, you have different costs per minute in the operation theater. This was one big challenge, to calculate the costs per minute in the OR or in the hybrid room or in the ICU. The second difficult task was to collect the data regarding the cost of every single material, especially in the endovascular procedure. We tried to identify the cost of every single material, sheath, guide wires, catheters, scaffolds, atherectomy catheters. So it was quite difficult. Nonetheless, we managed to collect data from different countries, different hospitals, different administrations. It was quite difficult, I have to say. But at the end of the day, the participating centers and the participating physicians managed to collect this data.
May I chip in as well? Just to say that indeed we were looking at many different sites, many different hospitals, if you like, across many countries. But if you look at the countries, we're looking at European countries at the end of the day that provide fairly similar secondary healthcare to these patients. We offer similar endovascular procedures and we use similar endovascular tools. What really does vary is the cost of those tools per site and per country. But because of the study design, we were able to go and look up the exact cost paid per patient, per instrument, per minute. And that's why we're able to report, despite the fact that you're looking at way too many sites, you might argue, as a health economist.
So having broken it down into the different buckets helped to actually make it comparable, the different systems, is that correct?
Exactly. You're looking at the constituents that drove up or down the costs per patient. And in essence, it's a micro-costing exercise, what we did here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It was quite interesting, to be honest, that when we went to the administration of the hospitals, many of them couldn't answer basic questions like, as I said, how do they calculate the cost per minute in the OR? So they had to do their exercise as well. And with the exception of NHS, what was made clear to me was that although you have many health specialists in the hospitals and administrations, we do not really understand the cost of the procedures and how expensive can a procedure be, even when you don't use expensive tools and materials.
That's why this study is so enlightening. Recruitment successfully identified 482 revascularization procedures in 13 centers over 5 years. Before we go on, Dr. Tsaratsis, was this more or less than the anticipated number of included patients?
In some ways, this was less than the anticipated number. We are all busy centers, but end of the day, we tried to find out the exact patients for which we had all of the data that we were looking for. But yeah, absolutely, it is very difficult to get that data for pretty much every single patient that walks past the door.
Intuitively, it sounded not that many, 482 over 5 years. On the other hand, in the article, you describe power calculations where a target of 263 patients were needed. So more than sufficient for the research that was achieved here.
Yeah, absolutely. We do properly do some power and sample size calculations beforehand, and everything reported in the article is within a 95% confidence interval. Mm-hmm. And we had done that prospectively before we started the data collection.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about the recruitment process and whether, in your opinion, there is any risk of inclusion bias, as in selecting more or less costly scenarios by the recruitment process alone?
Absolutely. There will be some selection bias because of the fact that these procedures had already taken place. We could not prospectively go and consent 500 patients and look at all the constituents of the healthcare costs incurred. So indeed, there might be some selection bias there. At the same time, we used a group called RCPAD, which is the Research Collaborative for Peripheral Arterial Disease, and we've been doing similar studies for about 3 or 4 years now together as a group. And we know that this is high quality data, and all of the sites have kept prospective data sheets of the revascularizations that they perform. And also we did data cleaning independently. Myself and a colleague of mine went through data in order to clean everything. And then I was going back to Kostas, and we were trying to make sure that we've got accurate and high quality data at every stage.
So those steps taken would have ensured a representative group of patients in the study?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can even see that because of the fact that we've reported all of the baseline characteristics. These are the standard patients that we treat in everyday practice. They've got lots of other cardiovascular problems. One interesting thing to note here is that quite a lot of female patients are included in this study, and we know that female patients, after revascularization, they're more likely to come back for intervention. So even that in itself shows that the study, in fact, can be translated to everyday real-world practice.
Thank you for that. That leads us well into the next part of our podcast, where we will talk about the results. Of the overall 482 procedures, 42% were endovascular only, 52% hybrid, and 6% open surgery only. The average age was 75. Technical success rate was 70%, with 4% major amputation rate and 1% mortality. 61% were Rutherford class 5 or 6. 67% had Tosaka class 3 disease, which corresponds to reocclusion. And 16% had proximal involvement of the common femoral or iliac arteries. Dr. Stavroulakis, would it be a fair assessment to say that this describes a study population in a relatively progressed state of PAD? And is this representative of the typical in-stent stenosis patient, or has this study magnified extra-sick patients?
Well, given that we instructed the centers to include all comers, I would say that, you know, they just include patients that treat in their everyday life. Of course, the majority of patients are CLTI patients. There are many different clinical scenarios that we see in patients with in-stent restenosis, but I think that in the big centers where you have a big volume CLTI, you see these patients again coming with progressive disease. This is something that we should not forget, that when a stent goes down, you might have a much worse clinical scenario than in the beginning of treatment of the patient. And this is something that we sometimes underestimate. I believe that this is something that you have to keep in mind, that when a stent goes down, you might have a much worse clinical scenario. And then you have big centers treating CLTI patients mainly. Given that we include patients that are all comers, I think that's quite representative. These are patients that we have to treat. The treatment of claudication is relative. I don't think that they have always an indication for treatment. That's why I think that this study is very important. Again, we see that in-stent restenosis, it's a very difficult situation of a technical failure of 30%. We have increased morbidity, not very high mortality, but again, we have patients staying in the ICU for a prolonged time, very high procedural costs, etc., which means that we have to deal with a very complex clinical scenario.
Thank you. I noticed that in the patient characteristics, only 5% of patients presented with acute ischemia. Dr. Tsaratsis, in your opinion, is this representative of your clinical experience of in-stent stenosis?
Yes, I would say so. recently for an ALI grant application, we've been looking at the number of patients that present in the NHS with ALI. And actually, it's less patients than what we think we're treating. So I would say that this is quite accurate. And again, it's a testament to the fact that the data collection process is pretty decent for this paper.
Thank you. Now for the main cost results. Dr. Stavrilakis, may I ask you to summarize the main findings? How much is reopening closed stents costing us? Which cost buckets were you able to quantify? And which of these is the carrying factor according to this data?
So based on this analysis or the findings of our analysis, we calculated that the mean procedural cost was something about 22,000 euro in this, at least in these centers, in these countries involved.
Sorry, that was 21,000 euros about, right?
21,000 euro, yeah. So we have more expensive procedures in the open surgery group and the hybrid group, and the main determinant for cost was not actually the materials, as we believed at the beginning of this research program, but was the time. So we all know that time is money, but we couldn't even imagine that time is the main driver of procedural costs. But this is what we found. And we see that time is actually the parameter that can really make a procedure very, very expensive, regardless of the treatment modality selected, if it's endovascular, open, or hybrid.
Thank you for that. Dr. Tsaratsis, which other aspects of the results would you like to draw our attention to?
To me, what I found quite surprising is the fact that the overall cost, if you like, of these procedures is at about 21,000-22,000 euros for that inpatient stay. But when you look at an endovascular procedure, it goes down to about 12,000-13,000 euros. And what I was expecting to see is the endovascular procedures, as in the endovascular TLRs, costing far more than the open surgery. But it turns out that these lengthy bypasses that we do when patients come back with occluded stents, they're actually quite expensive. So to me, that was the biggest surprise.
And that's sure. Because of what Dr. Stavrilakis mentioned earlier, that the main cost bucket is really the minutes of time in surgery being so much more relevant than the expensive endovascular modern materials that we are all looking at the price tags of.
Absolutely. And for me, the other thing, if you look at the breakdown of the anatomy of where these reocclusions occurred, you're looking at lots of popliteal lesions. So again, in my brain, it kind of reinforced the message that popliteal lesions are very difficult to treat. So you need to invest time and effort at baseline to make sure that you're offering your best type of treatment. Yeah, these are for me the two most important messages here.
Thank you. Your study provides new information on cost with an added insight to cost breakdown. Dr. Tsaratsis, what do we have to compare this data to? Can you put it into context for us, as presumably many patients, but also many caregivers, are unaware of the costs of their treatments?
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of things. First of all, to me, this provides a basis for future research. And what we do in the future should include things like what is the exact cost to the society and what is the impact to the patient's quality of life. Now, obviously, no patient would want to die because they've got a bad leg, and no one would want to lose their leg. Hence, a proper prospective health economic analysis, especially one that's looking at effectiveness, should take into account quality of life, amputations, death after these reinterventions. And it's impossible to do that with the data that we've got here. So that's definitely something that needs to be done in the future. Now, the second thing, which for me is a very important message from this, whenever I offer a patient of mine some form of treatment at baseline, I keep hearing about the costs of certain devices. And I keep getting all sorts of messages from management all the way to my other colleagues, essentially trying to understand why we're using these expensive devices in terms of endovascular tools. What we're seeing here is that if you don't use the right tools at baseline, then you're probably quite likely to encounter a very expensive revascularization procedure within months after your original procedure. So I think we need to be a bit more open-minded when we treat patients at baseline. And most importantly, we need to start properly looking into both the clinical and the cost effectiveness of all these expensive endovascular tools that we're using. And you can only do that with proper big randomized trials for every single tool that you're using to revascularize a patient's leg.
I suppose my follow-up question is almost a political one. Dr. Stavrilakis, can we as a society afford this cost? And what indeed is the alternative? Is there an alternative?
Well, it's more a philosophical question than a political one. I really cannot answer it. We have to think how we can offer the best treatment for the patient and at the same time keep the cost as low as possible. So what we understand from this trial is that even though spending so much money, it's not sure that it will offer the patient a proper treatment. As you see, we have a treatment failure of something like 30%. So what we can do is try to do the best thing from the first time. And I think this is the most important message, as Thanos said. The only way to reduce the cost is the proper treatment of the first time. When the reconstruction goes down, regardless if this is a stent or probably the TLR would be very expensive. And when I say that do the first thing right, I mean sometimes even avoid the revascularization first. It's very difficult. I'm not a health economic specialist, but I can say that I see that we spend a lot of money in patients that should not be treated. At the same time, there are so many patients that have to be treated, and then we should do the best thing for them, but from the first time, because every secondary procedure is probably very, very expensive.
Thank you. If I'm understanding correctly, what you're saying is it is a lot of money. Avoid TLR if you can. The cheaper way is to revascularize properly the first time. If you are in a setting of TLR, a lengthy bypass procedure is in fact not cheaper than a endovascular solution, even with expensive material.
More or less, I think, yeah, that's a good summary of what we're trying to say here. Very briefly, if I can add one thing, this philosophical question as to whether we save a patient's leg or not. I've been struggling with that for quite some time as a vascular surgeon, and I've actually in the UK been to quite a few debates where some of my colleagues were trying to convince us that it's better to amputate a leg in terms of cost effectiveness. We very recently published something in the BJS Open, which is a journal in the UK, looking at NHS-wide data. And surprisingly, if you are trying to save someone's leg, you're saving money and their quality of life is better and you incur less appointments in community care and primary care within the space of 1 year after that revascularization. So saving legs is indeed cost effective. Now, at the same time, I don't think Costas or I are advocating doing endless revascularization procedures in patients who are not on best medical therapy and haven't received adequate risk factor control.
Thank you for that. Saving limbs is indeed cost effective is an interesting message. I'll be sure to add the referenced article in the show notes below. This study is asking difficult questions. It's hitting that painful spot of the cost of a failed endo-first approach. How do you place this study in the context of basal versus bestialized trials? Should the study influence patient care policies, in your opinion, Dr. Saratsis?
Yeah, thank you for this question. It's quite complex to try and answer that question.
Yes.
I think the right patient needs the right type of revascularization, and that's why we cannot have an AI algorithm, for example, make decisions on our patients. You need someone with a brain and with experience. I think we need to take parts of the Basel III, Basel II results, as well as the best CLI results, which are very different studies. All of them are extremely different and heterogeneous studies. So we need to take all of those results, put them into context, and then make the right decision, like I said, for the right patient. There's no easy option, really. And what these very heterogeneous studies have shown is that certain tools work better for certain patients. So I would put that in that context. I think as clinicians, we have to be mature enough to understand the results of those studies and then put them into our clinical practice. And the final thing to say here, even Basel III, the results were only announced a few months ago at the Charing Cross Symposium. The paper is not out yet, but even Basel III is outdated now, before it's even been published, because the tools that we've got are completely different compared to what we were doing 4 or 5 years ago when I was recruiting patients into Basel III. So if you like, what I've got to take home from all of these studies and what we're trying to show here is the fact that every patient has got to go in a prospective trial of some description if they're having an endovascular treatment of some sort. Otherwise, we'll be left with no data trying to make decisions from very complex patients.
Thank you for that. Is this study highlighting the cost of a revascularization after stent occlusion would be perhaps an extra argument towards choosing appropriately some patients to be open first?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, but we've known that since the days of the original Basel trial. I think the younger patients with a very decent vein, proven again by best CLI, well, they probably need a bypass. But if you find these patients, please let me know where they are, because they're definitely not in the NHS.
Point taken. Thank you. Dr. Stavroulakis, do you think this study will influence guidelines, or indeed has it caused you to rethink any of your personal clinical practice?
I think that this study is a very good argument when you go to discussions with the administration, insurance companies, or in the vascular societies. I wouldn't say that changed my practice, but really changed the way that I understand costs. Because as Thanos said before, I've been in various meetings and discussions with colleagues saying you shouldn't go for endovascular first or endovascular after occlusion because it's very expensive. I really would prefer to go for a bypass, which is much cheaper, which is not the truth. I don't say that endovascular is better than bypass. I'm saying that the bypass is not cheaper than endovascular. It didn't change the way that I treat my patients, but change the way that I personally understand costs.
So to come back to the study and conclude this episode, Dr. Tsaratsis, what are the study's stated conclusions? What are the take-home messages?
The first take-home message is the fact that a TLR in the FEMPOP segment is very expensive. At least it's far more expensive than what I thought it would be. The second message is that the main constituent that drives up that cost is the time taken in order to revascularize the leg that's now got a problem. I'm not saying that we shouldn't offer bypasses as part of a TLR procedure, but what I'm trying to say is that we really need to look at how much time it takes to perform all of those TLR procedures when the patients come back to us. And the third thing, we've been saying this for the last few minutes, do things right when you first see the patient. What does that mean? It probably means that some people should have a bypass. It probably means that some people should have a drug-eluting stent, etc. But choose the right thing for that patient when you see them the first time round.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of today's episode. Thank you again to our esteemed guests, Dr. Tsaratsis and Dr. Stavroulakis, for sharing their inside view of this study. To our listeners, we appreciate you tuning in to today's episode. Look out for more Editor's Choice podcasts coming soon. Before we go, we would like to remind you that you can find all ESVS podcasts open access on Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and the ESVS e-library. Thank you very much.